Well, welcome to the Gear Garage Live Show. We do all kinds of weird shows here, different styles. This is just a podcast. We're going to talk to Greg McReynolds, the executive director of Idaho Rivers United, who is going to share with us probably a lot of things, but most interestingly, what rapids are under the dams on the Snake River. So welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks so much for having me, Zach. I'm really excited to be here. Long time listener.
First time caller. Well, it's very... roaring to me. It makes me feel special that you wanted to be here. So, you know, thank you for wanting to be on the show. I mean, what you had to share with us is super interesting to boaters, but also those of us that care about fish care about this too. And so I'm going to let you just share your thoughts and I'll pull up the map when we have time, when it's ready.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, I think obviously for us as boaters, a lot of us are coming off a little bit of disappointment. Those of us who aren't professional guides or maybe aren't in a position to run off-season trips, most of us got bad news, right? In the last two weeks, I think I got 15 rejections for that Gates of Lodore permit. They just really wanted me to know that I didn't get Gates of Lodore.
They sent you 15 emails. They didn't apply 15 times. You 15 times you got denied.
I just kept getting an extra email. And then you have to open each one because you're like, maybe this is it. Maybe they're telling me they were mistaken the first 12 times. I think, you know, a lot of folks are kind of suffering the aftermath of the permit apocalypse and thinking about what's next. And every year, you know, that gets me thinking about unpermitted rivers, right? And other opportunities. Obviously, IRU is really invested in taking down the lower four Snake River dams and recovering that lower Snake for a lot of reasons. One of the most important reasons is because those lower four dams are the most important impediment to recovering salmon in Idaho, right? Like, we know Idaho is the last best place for salmon in the lower 48, but there's these four dams on the lower Snake that just knock the heck out of salmon and have been doing it for 50 years. That's where a lot of our work is focused on for lower Snake is the need to remove those dams and provide salmon and steelhead with an opportunity to thrive in Idaho because we have that incredible habitat. Central Idaho it's high, it's protected, it's roadless, it's wilderness, it's, you know, all the pristine rivers that we love. And they're basically devoid of salmon. So, you know, that's a priority for us in removing those dams, but there's this other thing, right, that goes back to that permit disappointment. And it's that underneath those reservoirs between Lewiston and Pasco, there's 140 miles of river, right? And every time I don't get a permit, I think about what's there, right? We know there was 66 named rapids. There used to be two rapids basically in the town of Lewiston. There was Lewiston Rapid and Clarkston Rapid that were just above town and just below town. And when you float into, I'm sure lots of your listeners have floated into Heller Bar, there is a future, right, when those dams come down where that's just a stop, right? Heller Bar may be a put-in.
Wow.
Or it may be, there's a chance where Lewiston or Clarkston could be a resupply. Right. You could run, it'd probably be, well, it's 80 miles to Heller, right? So maybe a little more than maybe 90 miles to the town of Lewiston. Mm-hmm. You could stop, right? Pick up some supplies and then run another 140 to Pasco someday.
I'm going to bring up the map right now.
Yeah.
That you shared with me just to show people the watershed of the Snake River, which I knew there were Snake River dams out there. I had no context of where they were at all. Until I looked at the map. And the Snake to me is a very confusing river. It goes west, it goes north, it goes south a little bit, it goes back west. It's like a really confusing river as it goes. And I work on the Middle Fork of the Salmon and I live on the Columbia River. So one of my dreams at the end of the season is to paddle home.
Yeah.
Right? Like do the Middle Fork, go down the main, go down to the Snake. But it's just not realistic to do it, having to go through four reservoirs and four dams. But as you talk about this, I'm like, someday they can remove those. That would be like a dream come true to just paddle home at the end of the season.
Yeah. Well, I do you know, one thing I do want to say is like, there is no could remove these. Like these dams 100% are coming down. There is absolutely no question because they weren't built to last forever. These four dams were built with a 50-year lifespan in mind. So we are up against that right now. And, you know, the other reality that we're facing with these dams is that the value is diminishing. Their ability to do what they're designed to do is, it's not as good as it was. And it's going to continue to decline, particularly on the electricity front. The nameplate capacity for electrical generation on these dams is something like 3,500 megawatts across the four. They're down below 900, sometimes below 800. And a lot of that is because one, spill for salmon, right? They have to mitigate for salmon. So they have to spill water that they don't generate with. And two, water availability. Right now, I'm sitting in Pocatello. We're in one of the driest years we've ever experienced. This is the worst ski season I've ever had in my life. It's a tough year. And, you know, we look at a year like this and we know that there is not going to be a ton of water to generate electricity in the system, particularly on the lower four. So, you know, the benefits, and it is very clear there are benefits. There are people who do benefit from these dams. And that is an important part of replacing that infrastructure. We got to make sure that we look out for those people, but those benefits are diminishing, right? So we know they're coming down. The question is, how long is it going to take? What are we going to replace it with? And can we get them down in time to save salmon? Those are the only questions.
Greg, I don't understand. These were built in the 60s. Is that right?
Yeah. So they were authorized in 1945, started building in 1955, completed in the 70s. So okay. A 20-year process to build four dams.
All four at the same time. They were just all four authorized together.
They were authorized together by Congress. And that's an unusual situation with these dams. A lot of dams operate through a federal system. IRU is currently engaged on the relicensing process for the Hell's Canyon complex. Those dams have to go through what they call the Federal Energy Relicensing Commission process every 30, 40 years. The timeline kind of gets bumped out and we're way behind, but it's happening right now. The four dams on the Lower Snake were authorized by Congress. So what makes them different is that they never have to be reauthorized. And the only body that can authorize their removal is Congress. It's possible a judge could authorize their removal, but it's Congress. Congress is going to need to take action. And because they do provide services, the number one being barge shipping for grain.
Yeah.
Congress is going to have to authorize money to replace those services, right? We're going to need to build new roads. We're going to need to build railroad track. We're going to need to build new electricity. And, you know, we're going to have to plan for what comes after the dams. And Mike Simpson, Congressman Mike Simpson from, you know, my side of the state, did put together a plan to kind of think about how to do that. It wasn't a bill. It was more of a talking document, you know, and I think that document has a ton of really good ideas in it. And I think it's time for us to start having a real discussion about, okay, what do we actually want? What do we want? Not what do we have?
I've never heard, I'm going to go back. I've never heard anybody say the dams only had a 50-year lifespan, that was their, so they knew that building them, they would only have, because 50 years because they fill with sediment, or 50 years because they're just like going to get old or erode away, or why 50 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think infrastructure, we had a different mindset about infrastructure after the war, right? When these dams were authorized, you have to think about the moment in American history. We're coming out of World War II. West of the Mississippi, less than half the homes had a telephone. Most of the roads in the Pacific Northwest are dirt. This is, you know, this is not the modern world, right? Our grandparents came back after the war to a country that did not look that different than it did before World War I. And they had this mindset that we are going to do something better, right? Like they went into this thinking like, we have to build something for our grandkids, right? They're living on dirt roads with no telephone, with oil lamps. And they say, we are going to build electricity and we're going to make an inland port in Lewiston, Idaho, and we're going to put people to work, right? That was the real goal of building these dams, is they wanted to create jobs. They wanted to create opportunities. And while I certainly wish they hadn't built the dams, they did that, right? We see this big boom, this big economic boom that happens from 1955 all the way up until the dam's completion, where people are working, there's good jobs, stuff's happening. And I think, you know, in 1950, they were building interstate highways, right? They were building stuff. And that was the mindset, is like, this stuff is not going to be forever. And I think the people who, you know, had big dreams like dams and interstates and infrastructure, we should be those people, right? Instead of saying like, hey, I want my kids and grandkids to have the same infrastructure my grandparents built. Like, we should be looking at it and saying, hey, this is obsolete. We need to build something better. We need to build something newer, something that's fish friendly, something that is abundant electricity as opposed to the bare minimum. You know, we need to build the Pacific Northwest of the future that raises all of us up and is not, you know, we can't just be content to say like, yeah, that dam is good enough for me. And I think if you look like to your question specifically about the dams, Zach, if you look at those dams, I don't know if you've seen them, but
no, I've never seen them. I've seen videos. I've never seen them in person.
So concrete structure on one side that is basically a big lock, right? Because that's the main goal for the dams, is to move barges up and down the river. Then there's a powerhouse next to it. And then there's a very complicated spaghetti works of fish passage, ladders going over the dam, and bypass for smolt going down. And then the rest of it is just a huge earthen berm, right? These dams are mostly just dirt. And they don't have flood control. They don't actually have storage. They're what you call run of river dams. So basically the water that comes in is the same water that goes out. And the only thing they can control is, does the water go through the power generators,
interesting,
through the locks, or through spill? They can't hold water back.
I've learned a lot about these dams over the years. I don't always remember it. Can't put it together. I do remember hearing that. We're jumping back and forth all over topics, by the way.
That's me. Sorry.
Like there's the whole part about flood control, power, all that. The part that always blows my mind is that the fish actually do make it past these dams, all the dams, the Columbia dams, these dams.
Yes.
Is it true they're put into, the fish are put into trucks and driven around the dams?
Yes. The fish do go over the dams as adults, right? Like a fish that, like you see a fish on, let's say you see a salmon on the Middle Fork. Mm-hmm. That fish has come over eight dams. It's come over eight dams. It's been to the ocean. It's been out there for 5 years. Like this is a pretty amazing fish. And if you look at this map, thank you for bringing this back up. If you look at this map, you can see that there's two rivers, that are outside the Snake Basin, the John Day and the Yakima, right? You see those rivers? Mm-hmm. The John Day, those fish have to go over three dams. And if you look at those numbers, you see that those are sustainable numbers. That's the number of fish that come back. So on the John Day, if you look at Steelhead, for every 100 smolt that go out to the ocean, you get 5 back. That's a sustainable
number. That's a shocking number, actually, considering the journey they have to make and that they have to stay alive in the ocean.
Yeah, for sure. And then you look at Yakima, those are four dam fish, right? Those fish have to go over four dams. And you look at those numbers, 4% on Steelhead, 2.5% on Chinook. That 2.5% number is sustainable, right? We need 2% to sustain a population of salmon or steelhead. So we know that fish can sustain and even thrive when they have to deal with three or four dams. We've got that example on the Yakima and the John Day, neither of which have the volume or quality of habitat that we have in the Snake Basin and in the salmon drainage. The The Salmon River drainage is so far and above everything else in the lower 48, it's hard to compare it. But if you look at those numbers, you know, for Snake River, steelhead and salmon, we're below 1% on Chinook, and we're, you know, below 1.5 on steelhead. Those aren't sustainable numbers. There's a reason those fish numbers keep going down. And that's the race that we're in, right? With those declining numbers, every year news gets worse for salmon and steelhead in Idaho. So they, to the hydro system, I think that was your question, Zach, is like, they do go over, right? Adults are particularly good at going over dams. Like, these are amazing fish that have been out in the ocean. They've been dodging predators and sea lions and anglers, and they're tough. It's those small, you know, that come out of the system and they drift backwards, right? You're talking about a small fish that's, you know, maybe coming out of a place like Big Creek, and it's going out when, you know, late spring, water's high, it's drifting backwards. Everything's hunky-dory. It's on a journey that should take less than a week to get to the Pacific. But it starts running into these reservoirs. And they die in the turbines. They die in the stomachs of, you know, invasive species like walleye and smallmouth bass. They get eaten by birds. They just basically get crushed in these kind of slack water reservoirs, which they're just not designed to navigate. They're supposed to drift backwards, and they just can't do it. So when you get to the Pacific, you know, we know at least 50% of smolt die before they even get to the Pacific. But the number is actually way higher, because a lot of those fish, instead of taking a 4-day journey, they've taken a 3-week journey. They get to the Pacific, they're beat up, they're weak, they're tired. And they have to, now they got to face the biggest challenge of all, right? They're in the ocean and everything wants to eat them.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that number, that mortality is way higher. We don't actually know what it is because it's hard to track that. But we know that when we're looking at these numbers, right, for returns, most of those fish are not dying as adults. They're dying as smolts.
So let's go back, because this is the thing I'm most, my mind is blown by. Do we put the fish in cars and drive them around?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry. So we do, they do sometimes truck salmon, mostly sockeye is what that's been done with. They will also barge smolts. So they have basically a system where they'll trap smolt coming into the reservoir system, mm-hmm. and they'll put them on a barge and drive them down. And sometimes smolt will be captured at Lower Granite, and they'll be taken all the way down to below the lowest dam, below Bonneville.
Oh, wow.
The problem with that is, and this is the thing that always blows my mind, when you put salmon in a truck or in a barge and move them around, they lose their ability to find their way back. So once you start barging them, it doesn't...
That's a good point.
It doesn't actually increase survival. It helps a little bit, but it doesn't make a huge difference in survival. But what it does do is increase something called straying, which is basically fish don't go where they're supposed to, right? They don't return to their natal waters. And I think that's, you know, in a way, like it's really sad, right? To take something that has this incredible homing instinct and put it in a container ship and, or a barge, and drive it a few hundred miles and let it go. And now it doesn't know where it's supposed to go back to. Like, that's, to me, that's one of the saddest things about this whole situation.
So some of the salmon are caught on their way up and driven around the dams to help them get up. And they're saying, yes. Then some smolts are caught on barge ships and barged around to help them get down. So this is just people trying to increase the possibilities that they make it through our own mode of travel.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that, like, that illustrates another important point about salmon, is that almost every time I talk about this, someone will come up to me afterwards and they have a really great idea. You know, yeah. Have you thought about blank? You know, could you dig a channel around the dams? Could you, you know, use some kind of tube? There's been ideas to use, you know, like the bank teller tube, like basically like move salmon through a hose between, you know, the upper and lower. There's tons of ideas like that. The truth is, like, we've tried the stuff, right? We have dumped billions of dollars into replumbing the dams. We've done barging. We've done trucking. We've released tons of hatchery fish. You know, tons of stuff has been done. And it just doesn't work, right? Salmon are a creature that was here long before we were. They've survived volcanoes and ice ages and all this crazy stuff, and they keep coming back. So they don't need a truck. They don't need a barge. They don't need a magical tube that moves them from one place to another. They just need one thing. They just need a river, right? Yeah. Like, that's all they need. If we give them a river, the salmon are going to be fine. And the good news is, like, that actually lines up with what I want too, because I'd really like a river as well.
So I want to go get to that, because I feel like that's the main thing I think boaters want to hear about, is what this river is maybe like underneath. But before we do it, I work on the Middle Fork, and every year, you know, we have to be very careful to avoid the reds, which we do. But also there's a 12 boat limit put on us. So like after, I think it's August 12th, we can only have 12 boats as a group, which includes duckies. So that's sort of like, we can't have another ducky because of salmon. So we're very aware of what's going on. And anytime there is a red, and just for those of you that don't know, a red is basically where the salmon lay their eggs. They create a space, lay their eggs. We got to protect the red. It took me a long time to understand that too. Like, why is it called a red? Anyway, so we have to avoid those. And so they're tagged and they're geolocated. There's maps of where they're at. It's a big deal where the reds are on the Middle Fork of the salmon. This year there were none. They found zero. Like, this could be like the beginning of the end right now. I mean, it sort of feels that way. There'd be like 6, 7, 10 a year. And this year they found zero. So hopefully, like, we're on a time, like, we're on a, this is, they're going to die. Like, if we don't do anything, this is the end, right?
Yeah, we're really up against it. You know, salmon are really, really up against it. And just thinking about the Middle Fork, like, think about those years where you've been down there and it seemed like there were a lot of reds, right? That was
by a lot. There were like eight, not a lot. Right. There were a lot. There were some,
right?
But there should be a ton, like tons of them.
I mean, Idaho was allowing two fish a day for 3 months on the Middle Fork, like in the 60s. But it wasn't that long ago where that river was so full of salmon that, you know, people were going up there and spending 2 weeks and coming home with a pickup truckload of salmon. Like, that was in our parents' lifetimes. And before that, the Columbia, you know, historically they think the Columbia had 16 million salmon and steelhead in it. More than half of those came to Idaho, right? And the bulk of those in that salmon river drainage. So we're talking about when we're at eight reds, we're at like the last fish.
Yeah.
And when we're to none, no reds, like, yeah, this is the end. Good news though, Zach. I will just say, you know, there is still hope. I mean, because salmon and steelhead are these amazing creatures, they have really diverse life histories. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we have seen on rivers like the Elwha and the Klamath, right, where fish have been blocked from being able to return to those rivers. You take down the dams, and there are fish that their first option was the Klamath, and they couldn't go there, right? And they've got some genetic code that tells them to go to the Klamath, and they can't. And the dams come down, and they know, right? They're like, oh, I am supposed to take my first option, which is the Klamath, which is why on the Elwha and the Klamath, you take the dams down, and salmon come right back. They don't come back in big numbers, but they come back, even though they have been extirpated. So, you know, we don't want to lose salmon on the Middle Fork or in the Snake Basin, because we'd lose critical genetic history, and we'd lose our ability to have those really amazing, you know, runs like we did historically. But when we take down the dams, salmon steelhead will return, because they are, they're just magical creatures.
So that's, to me, that's the big thing, is like the thing about removing the dams to me is to increase salmon populations. Like that's why I care about this so much. Let's talk about the river though. What do you think if you remove the four dams, the whitewater is going to be like?
Yeah. Oh man. I love thinking about this. Right. You know, my guess is just kind of knowing that terrain, and I really love to hear your thoughts on this, Zach. My guess is it's probably lower salmon-esque, right? It's probably not Hell's Canyon, just by looking at the terrain. It's probably a little more open country. We know from the history that that was a pretty broad valley in the bottom, where there was a fair amount of, you know, small ag orchards and stuff like that. But it's going to be... it's going to be different, right? It's not going to go back to the river it was in 1955 when we take down the dam. So my suspicion is, like we've seen on the Lower Grand or in Cataract, you're probably going to have some pretty gnarly whitewater in the early years as the river sort of refines its channel.
Are the reservoirs back to back with the dams, or is there moving river in between the dams right now?
No, it's just 140 miles of reservoir right now.
So it would be, there's no river in between. There's just
nope.
The reservoir backs up on the next dam.
Yeah. The reason they built them, so these dams offer no flood control, and electricity was just a bonus benefit. They built them for barging. So they intentionally made this 140 mile long kind of slow, you know, Deadpool. The goal being so you can drive barges up it.
Do we know what the gradient of the river is between their, I guess, the total height of the dams?
Yeah. So each dam holds back about 100 feet of water, maybe a little less depending on the dam. But I think the average is around 100 feet. So, yeah, I mean, you don't have a ton of gradient, right? You probably got, 400 feet-ish between Pasco and Lewiston. I could probably look that up.
I'm actually searching ChatGPT right now to find the structural height. So there's 398 feet. There's basically 400 feet between them. There's 140 miles. Divided by 40. Wait, feet per mile. So I want 400 divided by 140. I mean, it's 3 feet per mile, which is not a lot. Yeah. But it's also a massive volume. So, there'd be some rapids. It's hard to say if there'd be a ton.
Right.
Which is always interesting to me. Like, I think a lot about why we do river trips. Like, everybody has different reasons. You know, it might not have great whitewater, but it might have like great camping, great fishing, just a chance to be outside. You know, some people have to have Class 3 rapids to go on a river trip, right? That's why all the multi-day Class 3 rivers are permitted. It's already a permit,
right?
As soon as the river becomes Class 4 or 5, you don't need a permit because it's too hard for most people. Right. As soon as the river's Class 2, it's too boring, so you probably don't need a permit. Right. Yeah. It's just those like wilderness Class 3 summer runs. They're the popular ones. And so this one would probably not have the whitewater, I'm guessing, at 3 feet per mile. Although there could be in there like a few zingers, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's my guess is like, yeah, you get that lower salmon where it's like you got a great trip with some nice beaches.
Yeah.
And there's a couple in there, just enough to keep it interesting.
Yeah. The cool thing is be able to paddle home.
Like, I mean,
that would be I've always wanted to do that trip. And I know I have friends who have done that trip, and the reservoirs are just epic undertakings.
Yeah. That there's that great film about it, right? About the kayakers.
Yeah. My friend Paul rafted it with them, and then he kind of gave up at one point and went back and finished it. But, you know, getting the raft through the wind, it's like so windy, a lot of places through the wind over the reservoirs was just unbelievable.
Yeah. I can imagine. I think, you know, to your point about like high demand, right? It probably isn't a permitted trip I mean, for sure, at first, it's not a permitted trip, but it might never be a permitted trip. Yeah. But that's, like, to me, we need more of that, right? Like, we need, it'd be great to have more unpermitted river.
Yeah.
Because we just, you know, where I live, there's not much.
Yeah.
We got some great fishing rivers. But not a ton of, like, multi-day rivers, even, you know, multi-day flatwater rivers.
So the thing I want to kind of finish up with is, like, what are the impediments to passing this? And from my understanding, when I've advocated for moving the dams, it comes, my perspective, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is it Cliff Bence, Eastern Oregon member of Congress, and then the Eastern Washington delegation in Congress, and then the Idaho senators. Mike Simpson is a member of representative, has put the best, most bold plan forward, which is a bold move as a Republican.
For sure.
All the Republicans in Eastern Washington, Cliff Bence in Eastern Oregon, and Rish and Crapo are all against this. Is that right?
That's true. Yeah.
And so we need, really, to get any movement, I'm guessing we need to get them on board.
Yeah, I think even more that those guys follow their constituents, right? And there are a lot of people in Idaho and Eastern Washington who just don't care that much about salmon, right? There's plenty of people who don't care about salmon, and they may not care about rivers either. It's just not their number one issue. And that's okay, right? I mean, there's things that maybe I don't care about. But those are for those of us that do care about it. I think what we have to do is we have to think about it in terms of what people do care about, right? And what they do care about is jobs, right? And the future of the region. And so when we're thinking about dam removal, it's not, it sometimes gets framed as a choice between salmon and the status quo, right? It gets framed as this negative thing where it's like, well, if you want salmon, everything else has to suffer. And that is absolutely not true, right? And we have to help our friends and neighbors, particularly our friends and neighbors who don't care about salmon, think about it differently, right? This is our moonshot, right? For the Pacific Northwest, if we want to recover salmon, we actually have to recover salmon as a bonus. We have to say to ourselves, we want to go build abundant electricity, right? We want to build electricity so that we never have another blackout or brownout in the summer or the winter. We want to build enough electricity so that it's cheap for people to start businesses. And that has to be new electricity because we're not going to get it from the current system. And we want to build new transportation. We want to put people to work. We want to think about, you know, the economics of the region. And we gotta imagine better than we have. And if we're not doing that, then, like, we are not recovering salmon or recovering river.
I haven't been to a meeting in Eastern Washington about this, but I've heard about them. And my understanding is that the people who live there are against the removal, and therefore the members of Congress, I guess.
Yes.
Are they against it because they like big lakes and water skiing, or they feel like, if they go, or they're like Lewiston's on a lake. If you take the lake away, there's just this big, ugly, like, dirt. Are they worried it's a lot farther down to the water that will change the look of the town? Or is it actually, are they worried about jobs?
I mean, I think change is hard, right? We've seen this in almost every campaign where you're trying to change something. And it's hard to imagine yourself in a place that doesn't currently exist, right? If you live in Lewiston, it just kind of is the way it is. And we have to help people imagine what it does look like, right? And part of that is, like, we can go back to 1955 and we know what it looked like, right? We know what those rapids were. We know that there was a big beach right there in town that used to be like the party beach for college kids and families. We know people used to fish in town. It's there's a roadmap to where we want to be. Some of it is we can see in the past, and some of it we have to imagine. But we gotta figure out like how we all fit into that, right? We have to help paint that picture so people can imagine, right, a future beyond the status quo. Because that's hard to do.
It's hard to do. And I think that gets me to the next step is like there's people listening, and a lot of times like, what can I actually do to help with this? And so what are the steps? And I'm just going to, first of all, I want to say like you're the executive director of Idaho Rivers United. Idaho Rivers United has a long history of conservation work through Idaho that is impressive. It's a very strong organization. And it seems like lately you guys have been really focused on this. This has been like a top priority among all the other things. I know there's been a lot of wins. So like when you have a lot of wins, it's like, okay, cool. What's next? This is the sort of the big thing. One thing I can say, if those of you want to help, it's the easiest thing to do is just give Idaho Rivers United money, right? Because that's what they need to do the work. Like I personally don't understand the nuances of this. So I can do a little bit. I can write letters to members of Congress. I can share my opinions on Twitter. I can go visit members of Congress in DC, but like, I don't understand the legal part of it. And so that's where you guys come in. Like you have expertise and lawyers who understand what needs to be done and when, and you're like, I'm sure you read really boring articles online that I fall asleep in the first few minutes. Or like you read the latest journals or whatever's coming out from the dams. And so like, as just a citizen, like I'm sharing what I think you do, and then you can correct me. The easiest thing to do is give organizations like Idaho Rivers United money, because that helps fund people who are doing very hard, boring work. Also, it helps Idaho Rivers United when they go to Congress, say, hey, we represent 10,000 people, 1,000 people, 200 people. The more people you can say you represent, the more political power you have when you go meet with members of Congress. So I'm gonna say the first thing people can do, and you're gonna correct me, I'm sure I'm wrong, and there's more, is give Idaho Rivers United money. But also, you can write your member of Congress a letter, and it can be so simple, like, dear member of Congress, I'm in your district. I know that I'm, you know, two states away, but I care about this big and you're moved. Put it on their radar, right? And then if you're in the district like Eastern Oregon, Western Washington, Eastern Washington, or Idaho, then it really matters. Then you are directly influencing the kind of decision makers in this world. And so that's what I think you can do. What else? Is that right? Is there more to that people can do?
Yeah, that's 100% right. I would say that was very kind of you. Thank you so much for shouting out Idaho Rivers United. I would say the most important thing is to pick a group, right? We hope it's us, but there are tons of groups doing really good work on the Lower Snake. You know, the Nez Perce are doing amazing work. That's an important partner of ours. They are, you know, really leaders on this campaign, especially on the education side. So find somebody and engage with them, right? Sign up for their email lists, go to their meetings, go to their webinars, and just start learning. That's number one thing you can do. You know, contribute to the cause. There's, you know, ways to contribute to the campaign that is well worthwhile. I would say the most important thing beyond those is believe in the power of change, right? Like, you have to believe that we can do this. We know that we can do this, and you have to believe it, and you have to move through the world like that, right? And that means sign up for email lists. It means going to meetings, and it means not just thinking this is too hard. It's never going to happen. I'm not going to deal with this, because that's not true. It's not too hard. It is going to happen. And it is really important that people who care about salmon and rivers do more than just wish for change, right? Like, we actually have to go make the change. And that is, as much as I wish it could just be, you know, me and the amazing staff at IRU that could change it, like, in the grand scheme of things, we're small, right? As you mentioned, it is the thousands of people who believe, who will eventually convince Congress to take down those dams. And so, like, every person who actually cares just do a little bit more. Start showing up. You know, make a call, be in a, go to a meeting, just do something.
I just want to expand on that. I've been a part of a lot of pieces of legislation that have passed. And every time along the way, it's taken way longer than we thought. People have been jaded, left offices saying Congress is corrupt. Nothing ever gets done here.
Yep.
Every time on the path, there's like the lulls and it seems impossible, but we just keep beating our head against the wall. And then at the right moments, you have the right people working on it. Maybe a member of Congress leaves, is replaced by somebody else who's maybe like more into what you're talking about. Like every time, if you just keep, if you have the right message and you have, and it's the right thing, it's going to be hard. It's going to take 10, 15, 20 years sometimes, but we have to keep at it. And eventually it gets through if it's the right thing. Congress also, in my opinion, is really good at sniffing out bullshit. People come to them with bullshit all the time. So if you come to something that's bullshit, they're the world's best deliberative body in their own words. They will figure out if it's not a worthwhile thing. This, everything I know about this is excellent. Like removing these dams, like it's like important for the fish, of course, but like, I think your vision is like the long-term it's important. You know, it's the long-term, like the new, a new economy that we have, a new transportation system, like the ability to float the river, like it's the right thing. And so I feel like every time I've been behind the right thing in getting legislation passed, eventually it's gone through.
Yeah.
This is a big one though. This one's a big, big one. And we have to keep at it.
That's right.
So
if it was easy, somebody would have already done it, right?
Yeah, we've been working on this for a long time. This has been on the table. I mean, since I moved to Oregon in 2006, 2007, we've been talking about it since then. And at first it was like, no, that's not possible. There's no way. And then, you know, when Simpson's plan came out, I was like, whoa, there's a plan. There's a Republican in Idaho for this. This is real. And so, you know, we get one more Simpson out there and it's just, as things start moving down, you know, eventually down the right path.
Yeah. And you know, somebody told me a few years ago, all we have to do is dream bigger than the guys who built the dams. Right. And when you think about it, like in 1945, they were like, hey, we're going to build four giant dams and we're going to move barges all the way to Lewiston, Idaho. Like that was a big dream. That's a crazy dream. Like people, like that is not a task to take on lightly. So I like to think about it in that context, right? Like what they did was pretty spectacular, but we have the capacity to do something even better.
Cool. Well, Greg, thanks for joining me. That's a good place to leave it. It's really interesting to be able to ask you directly questions that I have and be re-educated on this topic. And I'm sure a lot of people listening feel the same. And any final words before I shut this down?
No, I'm just happy to be here. Thanks so much for having us, Zach. We really appreciate you.
Yeah. Stay on. I'm going to turn this thing off for a little exit, but stay on so we can chat afterwards.
All right. Thanks so much.